Hey Central Ohio, the nationwide Children's Marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the nationwide Children's Marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's COTA.com. Good luck to all the runners.
94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Juan Castillo. This is the Electric Drum. And this morning, I have in the studio with me Stacy Cartier. She's a licensed clinical social worker. And she's been working at the Connecticut Mental Health Center. She's an independent practitioner. She's been doing this for about 23 years. And in fact, we're going to be talking about mental health in our community and other issues. How you doing today?
I'm doing great.
Wonderful, wonderful. So tell us about your life. Where did you grow up?
I grew up here in New Haven.
Okay.
Down on the shoreline. And my mom was a single parent.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a lot of support from extended family and friends, definitely. Grandparents were heavily involved in my life. And just really had a great childhood. I really
Any siblings?
One sibling.
Okay.
He was about 10 and a half years younger than me.
Okay.
He came along much, you know, a little bit later.
Right.
But yeah, we're really close.
Cool, cool. So where'd you go to high school?
St. Mary's High School.
All right. Tell us about that experience.
Well, it was interesting because when I was growing up down in Morris Cove, I was the only black child in a mostly predominantly white school.
Yes.
And so I was thrown into St. Mary's. By choice. I mean, I wanted to go to a Catholic school and I wanted something smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went to St. Mary's, it was pretty much, I'd say, 50-50 kind of black, white, Hispanic kind of. And so it was an experience for me because I wasn't actually used to being around, you know, other girls of color.
Right. Wow. So that definitely changed you then.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, you had a lot of lumps in the beginning because, you know, in my mind growing up, I mean, I've always considered myself, you know, a black girl.
Right.
And so when you go into other circles and other people are then kind of defining kind of who you are
right. And
where you're supposed to sit, not so much because of the way I looked, but pretty much because of the way I spoke or I just didn't act like other girls.
Right. And somehow in the black community, folks seem to want to define us as, you know, folks who, number one, speak in slang, number two, pretty much have a rhythm in the way that we talk, and we're very much into pop culture, right?
Yeah, you know? And I think it kind of emboldened me because I was committed to not fitting in, not following through and fitting into any specific group.
Right.
So there would be days of the week that I sat with, you know, the Italian girls from East Haven, and there were other days of the week that I sat with a crew of girls of color. And I always felt comfortable kind of bobbing and weaving in between the two. Other people may not have, but right. I definitely always did.
So in high school, what were some of the things that you gravitated to in terms of hobbies and in terms of even your interests as far as education is concerned?
Oh, well, I love to write.
Okay.
Journaling, I started very young. My mom always kept a journal. She's no longer with me now, but to this day, I have volumes and volumes of her journals that she wrote, and she always wrote to her children.
Mm.
She wrote about her day. She wrote about all of that stuff. So I would always write. And part of the work that I did in high school was, particularly when I was preparing to get into college, I submitted a lot of the creative work that I was, you know, writing in class. So there was a particular teacher that was very inspirational in that way, making sure that I always, you know, used my voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, I think that was really helpful in kind of helping me find my voice and keep it.
Yeah.
And so I think that I gravitated towards community service really in high school because it was actually part of the curriculum. And I was taking care of a woman who was a quadriplegic.
Yes.
And I would just, you know, spend time with her and I would, you know, cook her a light meal in the afternoon after school and things like that and, you know, help her get into the bath, almost doing nursing aid work, but I was only, you know,
right.
17, 16-year-old
right.
girl. But it really, you know, opened my eyes to, you know, how other people live and how it's important to really, you know, touch people's lives in the way in which you can with what, you know, strengths you have.
Right. So it was time for college. So you went to UConn. What made you decide to go there?
Well, it was a huge decision because all of the girls I grew up with and my best friends, they went off to, they all went off together, and they all went off to Central. And my mom said to me, you know, you're at a crossroads here. You could be like everyone else, or you could be like Stacy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went alone, and I was in the CAP program, which is sponsored by the Center of Academic Programs, which takes disadvantaged youth and youth who basically may not have a lot of money, or there's certain criteria for those students, kind of like Upward Bound, you know, sometimes kids go to.
Yes.
So I went into that program. So I actually started UConn the summer before freshman year. So I did 6 weeks that summer. And that was pretty, it was a fun experience, but it was a hard experience. You know, the academics were very rigorous that summer, you know, as well as, again, being in a different environment and then having to fit in now with a new group of young people.
Right. This is Juan Castillo. This is the Electric Drum. And today we're speaking with Stacy Cartier. She's a licensed clinical social worker. She works at the Connecticut Mental Health Center. She's an independent practitioner. And we're talking about her life. And we're going to be talking about mental health in our community, something that she's been doing for over 23 years. So we're at the part in her life where, you know, she is now entering UConn, you know, for her undergraduate work. So UConn, I've always wondered, like,
go Huskies,
the middle of like nowhere, cows and nothing to do. I mean, new for you? I mean, because like you didn't really live in that kind of environment, right?
Well, it wasn't New Haven, that's for sure. But
yes,
I did not feel uncomfortable because, I mean, UConn is a very, you know, predominantly white school.
Mm-hmm.
The beauty of UConn, though, is that, you know, there's the rich in culture in terms of the African American Cultural Center, the Hispanic and Latino Cultural Center. They're very vibrant on campus, and they were very vibrant on that campus. And because the majority of the kids that I actually started that freshman year with that summer were minorities for the most part, I was able to, you know, identify a nice, you know, peer group.
Mm-hmm.
So that I eased into, you know, my freshman year with a core group of friends.
Right.
And then I was able to kind of take in the rest of the campus and still felt very comfortable, obviously.
Yes.
You know, struggled initially with academics because now I was used to being, you know, one of 17 girls in a class. And now I was one of 217.
Right.
So, you know, it took a while to get, you know, that adjustment underhand, but luckily I was able to push through. And then as I became a little bit more mature, like socially, you know, I was able to kind of look around on campus to see, you know, what could I do next in terms of service. And that's actually when I, you know, found Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority.
Okay.
Or they found me.
Yes.
And that was another life-changing event because I was able to really take all the ideas that I had in terms of public service and how to match that with an organization that, you know, that speaks to my heart and also provided me with the sisterhood, you know, that I think that I was longing for.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, there's all kinds of thought about, you know, joining fraternities and sororities, you know, so it was good for you.
Oh, definitely. Right. I mean, it's a lifelong commitment.
Right. That's fantastic. So time to graduate. Well, what did you end up majoring in, by the way?
I was accepted into the School of Family Studies, and I majored in Human Development and Family Relations. So I think from that point on, I knew that, you know, mental health was something that I was going to be committed to. And I actually started volunteering at the state mental hospital that was Norwich State Mental Facility. And I think I started doing that my junior year, and I did that for 2 years until I think they started to close the program. They started to close the big hospital.
Right.
And so that was inspiring because I got to actually sit with, you know, patients who were really struggling. They were long-term inpatient hospitalization. And, you know, it was very moving to me. And I was like, I love these people.
Tough population. Wow.
Tougher the better.
Really?
I love it. I mean, I love my job. I love what I do.
Wow.
I'm always humbled, you know, by someone else's story. And I'm always humbled that someone who's struggling, you know, the way in which they are, when they're not feeling safe, they're not feeling comfortable, they're feeling very alone. You know, when I'm able to reach out and touch them and say, you know, let's talk about this, or how could I help you? Right. What could I do for you today? What could I do for you right now to help you feel better?
Right.
It matters.
Yeah.
And they, what I realize about people who are really struggling with serious and profound mental illness is that they recognize who can help. Who wants to help? They know if you're just kind of, or how are you today? Are you doing okay? They really want real interaction, you know, an intimacy in the professional relationship and you know, with a client professional relationship. They want to know that you really care. And I think just kind of my natural sense of self and being just, I think it lends itself to that.
It fit. Yeah. And how do you leave it there and when you get home?
Well, I mean, when you're a mental health provider, and I, you know, there's others who may be listening who would agree with that, or whatever, if you're a firefighter, any kind of public service, self-care is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And self-care is the number one kind of mental health treatment for the provider.
Yes.
You know, so it's about knowing who your resources are, using your friends and family in the way that, you know, you should. Taking a time out, knowing when to walk away from a situation and to say, you know what, I need some me time. It's okay to take a day off and take a mental health day for yourself.
Right.
And then do the things that you love. It always brings you back to nurturing other people when you're doing the things that you love.
Right.
And so I love to travel. I love to spend time with my girlfriends. I enjoy a glass of wine every so often. Mm-hmm. And so that's how, you know, I take care of myself.
Do you feel like, and I don't know, maybe that might be the case, like, you know, that folks that do your job, you know, maybe need to also be in therapy to kind of understand the process?
Well, you know, when you are in graduate school, or at least, I did a fellowship, at Yale University, and part of the requirement is, extensive supervision. Mm-hmm. So you just don't have one supervisor that you talk about the work and your cases. You have four, or at least,
right?
At least I did at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so those four people kind of help you not just talk about the patient and the work, but help you manage your emotions about the work.
Yes.
So that there's, you know, there's concepts of transference, meaning how you feel about a particular patient, you know, and what that brings up for you, or what you may bring up in a patient that would be countertransference. So it's important to be really cognizant of that and to check it. And so when you have really good supervision and support, you know, from your colleagues, you know, you're able to have that dialogue to say, you know, I don't really like this person. I have to, you know, I have to treat this person,
right.
But I don't like them.
Right.
You know, and it comes into play all the time. I mean, as a mental health provider, I might, and I think this has actually happened in the past. I had someone who was, you know, a sexual predator who had, you know, harmed young people, children.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as someone who's always, you know, been around young children and, you know, I love the kids, so to speak, to be with someone who's harmed them. And to know it's my obligation to treat them and to actually help them, you know, manage those symptoms and to recover.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a challenge.
Right.
You know, and the particular person I'm actually thinking of, I came to actually like the person. And I shudder to say that, you know, out loud, but it's
right.
Really true.
Right.
Once I was able to get a better understanding of how, what his journey was and how this particular individual came to that. I mean, no one hated him more than he hated himself.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a really eye-opening,
right.
You know, kind of experience. So it makes you want to scratch the surface just a little bit more and to understand a human just one extra step.
Right.
And that's how you know, like, you know, what you're able to do with them and how you're able to help them on their journey. Because all we are, you know, we're mirrors of, like, of self-reflection, letting people kind of move along in their path.
Right. Seems like there's a lot more attention on mental health today.
Thankfully.
You know, yes, absolutely. You know, and of course, you know, it's come about because of some very, very bad things that have happened in our country around the shootings and you know, Newtown and all of that. Do you think that has helped in terms of people really being a little bit more cognizant of what's happening in their own homes and maybe being more open to understanding when someone is going through some difficult times from a mental health perspective?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think that there's more awareness, but the statistics are still up. You know, one in five Americans are dealing with, you know, a major mental health issue.
Yeah.
That's one in five.
Why do you think that is?
You know, here, we're such a fast-paced country. You know, in general, I think a lot of us, we're always on the move, and we don't always take the time to take a step back. And also, you know, we're, the way in which we often deal with things, we're not really dealing with the heart of the matter. I mean, there's so many different, like, social transgressions that happen that would impact that, you know?
Yeah.
But I would say we just don't really take the time to listen to each other.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I work in music, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. And, you know, we have issues in the music industry today because, you know, people are just buying singles and they're not really, people aren't really caring about lyrics anymore as much as they used to. So songs have a different kind of feel to them. And, you know, in the past, and, you know, we just finished talking about vinyls, you know, and how important, how vinyl was coming back. You know, people used to actually sit down and listen to a whole project, right? Because the whole project told a story, right? You know, and you felt what that particular artist was trying to accomplish. So it was a sit down kind of thing. You know, it's like, okay, I'm gonna block everything else out, and I'm gonna listen to this thing, right? Like, that doesn't happen today.
Right. You know? I mean, when you look at the, you know, the greats, you know, like a Coltrane, like you put something on and you listen to that whole thing, and it takes you on a journey.
Right.
And you don't see that, you know, as often. But it's reflective of kind of how fast paced, you know, we are, how I think social media has probably impacted us negatively in that everything is a quick click.
Right.
Versus really paying attention. We're not awake.
And having a conversation. And actually having a conversation with another human face to face, right?
Right. I mean, we're quick to just kind of type something up, text it very quick.
Right.
If you think about it, most times, if you're going back and forth if you're in an argument or a heated discussion via text message, 9 times out of 10, you're missing half of what that person is saying.
Absolutely.
You know, you will be in trouble by the end of that text message.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you said something, I didn't understand how you said it. This is the way you said it.
And I tell folks all the time, please call me. You know what I'm saying? Call me.
Definitely.
I still want to talk to you, you know, especially around some issues that, you know, that are important, you know. So we live in this society today. By the way, folks, this is Electric Drum. I'm Juan Castillo. I'm speaking with Stacey Cartier. She's a licensed clinical social worker. She's an independent practitioner. She works at the Connecticut Mental Health Center, and she's been doing this work for almost 23 years. And we're talking about mental health in our community, mental health in this country, and how we're dealing with it. So in terms of treatment, right, you know, it's like, I think that on the most part, you know, there's a stigma attached, you know, as much as we're having all this conversation or whatever, among all races, right? There's a stigma attached to someone has a mental health issue, right? You know, families don't want to talk about it. They want to hide the person, you know, that still occurs.
Definitely.
Right. How do we overcome that? And how do you see that playing out?
Well, I think, you know, forums like this, I think, are important because, you know, everybody in our community listens to 9 to 4.3.
Well, thank you.
I think that's important because, you know, the mom or the dad at home who doesn't have, you know, cable, but is listening to the radio,
right,
you know, might be listening to this. And they might be struggling with some things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, also educating our young people, I think, is key. I mean, I often, you know, I'm engaging with young people and they're talking about a lot of serious things that are happening, you know, in grammar school, high school, you know, things that they really can't wrap their minds around. And so having a dialogue and having someone to give them honest answers to their questions. I mean, just personally, you know, I have a 6.5-year-old son. He takes the bus. Every day I have a very interesting question from what he heard on the bus.
Mm.
And, you know, after I clutch my pearls, I answer him, you know, in the way and with the information that a 6-year-old could and should have.
Mm-hmm.
But he gets the correct answer. You know, it's no baloney, and it's from his parent. You know, and he does the same thing with his father. And that's, you know, really important.
You're taking time out to have this conversation. That's important.
Yeah, I mean, he was asking me about homosexuality the other day.
Right.
He wanted to know what a lesbian was.
Yes. Wow. That's deep.
Yeah. But
absolutely.
You know, I said, well, actually, I was like, you know, several lesbians. And I named our people that we know.
Mm-hmm.
And that.
Right.
And it was that simple for him.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly. I might have been all twisted. Like, why am I explaining this?
Right.
But
right,
for
right,
him,
right.
He was like, oh, okay.
Well, you know, I mean, personally, I mean, I'm an ex-addict, you know, a recovering addict, you know, still trying to, you know, stay off. And, you know, having gone through therapy, the talking cure, I think I've become a better person because of it, right? And I've always thought, wow, I think almost everybody should do this, right? You know, because...
It's scary,
but I think that the other part of that, though, is the fact that I think that, you know, we, especially in the African-American community, I mean, it's like, you know, we have therapy. It's like, you know, we go to our friends and mm-hmm. we lay it out.
Yeah, kitchen right? table.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and we go back and forth. And a lot of times, you know, because we're too close, like... You don't get nothing out of it other than maybe, like, sometimes it's worse.
Yeah, your lumps. You get the lumps.
yeah. You know what I mean? And so, you know, having said that, you know, like you said, you know, education and getting folks to understand that. You know, I think that the other question I have for you is, like, religion comes into very heavy into this, right? You know, we're going to leave it to the Lord, right? You know, and when folks come to you, right, you know, family members, right, that, you know... You were the last resort now because, you know, they've tried to
they
give it
to their
the
pastor.
Lord. Right.
They've been praying on it for a long time.
Right.
But, you know, Malcolm still hears voices.
Mm-hmm.
And all those other things didn't really work. And so now it's time, you know, to let other people who, you know, the Lord has given a gift, if this is what you believe, let them try. And it's not easy. And
right.
And very often, I mean, you know, that's why I think, you know, NAMI is such an important organization because they really are trying to bring families to the table. Because if you're struggling with something.
What is NAMI, by the way?
Oh, NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill.
Okay.
And so they provide great educational resources. They have meetings every week, and there's a NAMI right here in New Haven, and you could go to NAMI.org.
And they involve families along with in the therapy.
Yes, yeah. So it gives you a lot of information, a lot of education. It's a national organization,
okay.
But there's, you know, a lot of grassroots programs throughout the United States, and there's several here in Connecticut. And so partnering with them is really important because it gives the family a voice. And so if Malcolm is in treatment, his family could also benefit from the resources that's free from NAMI. So there's groups that happen every week, you know, different things like that to provide them with information so that they know they're not alone. When someone has a problem, whether it be addiction or they're struggling with depression, the whole family has a problem. Everyone that loves them is struggling in some way.
Right.
So it's really important to get, you know, as many people involved. And recovery is real, and recovery definitely can and will happen. But when you have your true village behind you, it happens even tenfold.
And getting your work done. I mean, obviously, you know, you find out sometimes that, you know, family sometimes is part of the problem, right?
Definitely.
You know, and there's some triggers that, you know, I mean, I know of, you know, some of the guys that, you know, went through treatment with me that, you know, they had to move, man. You know, they had to move away from their families because, you know, that's what, there was a lot of triggers within that family because they didn't really understand, right, what the process was that they were going through. So they had to stay away from their families to some degree, right? I mean, how do you overcome that? I mean, because...
From the individual standpoint, yeah, or how do you...
Well, yeah, in terms of like...
Or how do you juggle the family,
yeah, right,
the
right,
family
right,
system right, when someone's struggling?
And how do you deal with that, you know, while you're treating someone?
Well, I am very no-nonsense, and I'm very direct. And once I know I have the trust of my client, then if we're looking to bring the family in, like, so if a client said, you know, I'm really struggling, you know, with this depression, you know, but my wife just doesn't get it. She doesn't understand. You know, we'll talk about how we may, you know, do some family work, or I may refer out. I may not do it all myself because you have to use your resources, and you also have to know what your strengths and your strengths are. And you never want to undermine, you know, the client therapist relationship.
Okay.
You know, so I might say, well, maybe your wife needs to see a colleague of mine and we could refer out. And then there may be a moment when we might make a decision for some family work and kind of bring it together to bridge.
Right. Yeah, because I mean, in a lot of these cases, it's a blame game, right?
Totally.
I mean, because it's like, you know, well, the reason I am this way is because of you, right? And the things that you say to me and how you deal with me, right? Big conversation today about medication, right? So, some people, you know, I've seen it work, and some people, I don't know if that was the best thing for them. I mean, they're walking around like zombies the whole night. Talk to me about that.
Okay, so I hear you, and I definitely agree. And now I work on an inpatient psychiatric unit.
Yes.
And so when someone comes in, they're usually at their worst.
They're in bad shape.
They are unmedicated. Their symptoms are extremely problematic for them, the people that love them, and even their community.
Yes.
Where they may be unsafe. And so oftentimes they don't come directly to us. They may have spent some time at one of the local hospitals. And they have a particular philosophy, you know, in terms of how they utilize medication to get people stabilized quickly and out of the hospital relatively quickly.
Okay.
That's not always a good thing.
Okay.
But when we get someone, our job, it's basically required that we need to stabilize them over a longer period of time. That's kind of why we get that patient,
okay,
you know, in terms of my agency, because we serve the profoundly mentally ill and indigent. So I always see my role, you know, as the social work clinician is to speak truth to power, you know, and I say it almost every day at work.
Mm-hmm.
So a doctor may prescribe medication. And in the course of, you know, getting this person stabilized, you could tell that the medication is having, you know, you want to get a maximum benefit of the medication without the bad side effects. And
right.
Unfortunately, just like all medications have side effects.
Right.
So the person that you said really, you know, doesn't look good might be because they may be over-medicated. And so my role in speaking truth to power is to kind of broker, you know, between the physician who wants to treat and wants to treat well.
Right.
And the patient who is saying, you know, I can't even get out of bed in the morning. How am I going to go back to my job?
Right.
And so then we begin the dialogue. And my role is to help the patient and empower them to use their voice to say, this is what this medication at say 100 milligrams is doing to me. So we say, what would it look like at 80 milligrams? Mm. And kind of negotiate that with the physician.
Right.
And, you know, most physicians are really open to learning from the patient.
Okay.
At least, you know, definitely the one that I work with. And sometimes, you know, you need the social worker to say, you know what, we're not going to get what we need from this patient, and we're not going to really be able to nurture that person's goals if we're snowing them, you know, and they can't get out of bed.
Yeah. And
so I speak up loud, you know, during those times, and that's where I use my advocacy, and I do use my voice, you know, in that way.
So I never thought about the over-medicating part of it. You know, I never thought about that. And so where does the family come in terms of advocacy, right?
Well, all patients, you know, have the right to have their families involved.
Yes.
And they also have the right to not have their families involved.
Okay.
And so, you know, you basically have to follow, you know, protected health information, you know, so I can't automatically speak to your loved one, like, unless it's a dire emergency, without, you know, you actually saying that you give permission.
Right.
So that is also a challenge, because sometimes when people, you know, are first getting sick, they don't want anyone involved. They're embarrassed. They're worried. They don't want their employer to know. They don't want their friends to know. They don't want the people that love them most sometimes to know. So it's a, you know, I really see it as my role is to educate the client into how it could be beneficial, you know, for their village and the people that care about them to know, so that they could advocate for them as well.
Right. I'm Juan Castillo. This is Electric Drum, speaking to Stacy Cartier. She's a licensed clinical social worker. She's an independent practitioner, and she works for the Connecticut Mental Health Center. She's been doing this work for 23 years. We're talking about mental health in our community. Very important issue. You mentioned employers, right? You know, where do we stand today with that? I mean, are there laws that employers can really discriminate against the mentally ill? Like, for instance, you're working, you develop a problem, you get depressed, right? And you've got to get treatment, right? Can they hold that against you in terms of being able to come back to work?
Well, there's definitely laws against that kind of discrimination.
Okay.
And you do not have to disclose directly to your employer what your medical issues are, mm-hmm. necessarily. I think you just have to be careful, because not everybody has that clear understanding of mental health. Like you mentioned before, I mean, there's stigma.
Yes.
And so, you know, I always encourage people to let people know what's going on, but at the same time, they have to be careful.
Understand the reality of the situation.
Yeah, the reality of, I mean, it really depends on what's going on with the individual. Like, I'd have to have like a case by case, really, to be able to speak in that way.
And then also which employer, if your employer is going to be cool with it.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, I don't know that it's their business. I mean, some degree.
Okay.
I mean,
right.
if you are someone who you know you're doing everything you're supposed to do.
Right.
You know, you might say, you know, sometimes, you know, what if I had Tourette syndrome? And I was like, sometimes I yell out and I say, hey, you're silly. And I yell it out all the time. Like, someone's going to ask, what are you doing?
Right.
You know?
Right.
So, you know, I think it's a fine line, but there are federal laws that protect people from being discriminated against, just like, you know, by virtue of race, color, creed,
right.
sexual orientation,
okay.
you know, illness as well. And if you're out of work for a period of time, you take medical leave.
Right. Which you have a right to.
Right. And so really,
they don't have to know what's going on.
Right. It's only, there's a form that gets filled out that gets sent to HR. HR is not supposed to obviously, you know, disclose to everyone, you know, in your office.
Right.
What that's about.
You deal with the acute, right? But there's a lot of depressed people running around, right? And that sort of leads to worse situations, right? From a mental health perspective. Or is depression pretty much this thing that, you know, you can just like work on it and get better? Does it lead to, you know?
I wouldn't say it necessarily leads. I would say that, you know, people know, you know, when they're feeling bad.
Right.
There is such a huge continuum, you know. Some people might say, oh, I'm so depressed. And they're really kind of using it for, I'm just feeling kind of not blah. I'm not feeling myself. I'm feeling in a funk.
Right.
You know, but profound depression mm-hmm. is something that is definitely, you know, it's as much a medical illness as it is, you know, a mental health concern. Mm-hmm. Because someone who's profoundly depressed may not eat. You know, may have difficulty getting out of bed in the morning, may lose a lot of weight, may start to, you know, hallucinate, you know, because they're not eating, they're not taking care of themselves. I mean, depression is no joke. And, yeah. you know, treatment is available and treatment is definitely an option. You know, usually people do need to take medication to kind of help lift the mood a little bit. You know, right. the neurotransmitters in the brain, you know, need help, you know, when someone really slips into that level of depression.
Success stories. What are they, many?
Oh, you know.
I mean, I guess that's relative, right?
No, well, yeah. So before working inpatient, I worked outpatient for a number of years. And, you know, I had the opportunity to come up, you know, and meet a lot of different people. And so I always say I'm just as lucky I have interacted with them as they may feel of having, you know, being treated by me. So there's a woman in particular that was came here from Seattle, Washington, and she was suffering from schizophrenia, and she had a very specific delusion that, you know, people were clones. Mm. And she packed up her two children and she moved all the way. She came all the way to New Haven, where she knew that she was supposed to work on the campus of one of the colleges. And she shows up at their human resource and she ended up getting, you know, interacting with the police because she knew she had a job there, although she did not.
Right.
So this is all part of this delusional system that she had.
Yes.
And she had, you know, a 9 and a 10-year-old in her car. So she ended up, you know, in the legal system, in the DCF system also, because the kids, you know, were taken away.
Wow.
And she was hospitalized for a period of time. And at some point she ended up coming in and being in my care. And that woman was probably one of the brightest women I know. And she had two master's degrees. Mm. And once she got on some medication and once she realized kind of or was able to see, you know, the course of action that she took while ill, she really worked so hard to do everything she needed to do to work on, you know, getting her kids back. Mm. Every hoop that was put in front of her, she jumped and danced through to the point where she ended up getting a job that actually paid more than I was getting paid at that time. And she, you know, kind of utilized the system for a short period of time that, you know, that she could. And, you know, the next thing she knew, she was, you know, leaving New Haven, going back to Texas with her children. Her children were excelling in school. She was able to reconnect with her eldest son, who was at the University of Colorado playing football, and she really just got it. And my number one thing to her is that this is the illness you have. Because honestly, Juan, you know, mental illness should not be treated any differently than any physical illness. Mm. Diabetes, a broken foot, you have to be diligent.
Right.
And you have to know that it happens. And if you don't treat it and you don't treat it early, just like anything,
yeah,
it's going to proliferate and it's going to get worse.
Mm.
And so this woman, she stayed on her meds. And to this day, now it's probably about every year, I hear from her.
Right.
And she checks in. And she says, I'm still taking my meds. I just want to let you know.
Right.
And she's working for an airline. She's doing she's doing a great job.
That's awesome.
And that is, I always speak of that success story because yes. it's so profound because where she was almost, you know, in jail, losing, you know, two of her children, estranged from her family, estranged from her oldest child, it's just, it was amazing.
Well, I got to tell you this. It's interesting because I've been doing this for a long time, and I watch television and I read papers, and you know, this is the first time that I've heard a success story from the mental health area.
There's so many.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, that just goes to show you, right, that somehow either the media or people in general don't seem to think that maybe that is that important, number one, to tell those stories, because, you know,
because of the stigma.
Exactly, right?
But there's so many. I mean,
that's fantastic.
If someone's in treatment, doing what they're supposed to do, and taking their medication and living their lives and bringing their kids to school and going to work every day, that's a success. I mean, how am I to judge, like, you know, you have this person over here having a mental illness, me not thinking I might have a mental illness, but some people might defer, you know?
Right.
So, I mean, it's...
I was going to ask you, my next question was going to be, you know, I know that you do a lot for these folks, and I'm quite sure they recognize that, but I was going to ask you, what does it do for you? But I can see that.
Oh, it's... I mean, I'm just humbled. I mean,
yes.
You know, from a very young age, you know, my mom always said to me that you affect people in a positive way, and you kind of, you know, you let your light out. You have to let it shine, so to speak.
Right.
And so I do that. And I'm not someone, I'm not a bragger in terms of I do this or I do that. If I help somebody, no one needs to know.
Exactly. Right.
You know, I just need to know.
Yeah, you know. It's great. Oh, man. Stacy Cartier. Thank you so much for coming. Before you leave, what's the best advice you ever gotten from who?
Okay. Best advice, I would say, would be from my mother, who always said, don't do it the easy way. Do it... Oh, no. That's the wrong... Now I can't even think of it. Now you got me nervous.
No. But I'm quite sure...
I'm sorry. Don't do what's easy. Do what's right.
Okay.
That was it. Don't do what's easy. Do what's right.
I like that. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much.
And please come back with another one of those great stories. The community needs to hear those.
I will.
And, you know, this is Electric Drum, Stacy Cartier. I know you've been inspired. I have. Thank you again for coming.
Thank you so much.
Juan Castillo with you. This has been the Electric Drum. I will see you next week. Have a wonderful week.
Juan,
Hey, Central Ohio. The nationwide Children's Marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the nationwide Children's Marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's COTA.com. Good luck to all the runners.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast12. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast12. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.